The sinking of the Titanic, April 15th, 1912. Perhaps the most famous maritime disaster of all time. The tragedy claimed the lives of more than 1,500 passengers and crew of that famous ship. At the time, it was the largest ocean liner that had ever been built and was touted and deemed to be unsinkable. Yet that great ship struck an iceberg and sunk within 2 hours and 40 minutes. On board that ship were some of the wealthiest men in the entire world at that time. Also on board that ship were some of the most deeply impoverished of that day and time. The wealthy were on their way for an adventure. The poorest of the poor were on their way to a better life. So that day when that great ship sunk, it was rich and poor, old and young. The sinking of the Titanic had no respect for a person's station in life or a person's age. Since then, there have been motion pictures made about the sinking of the Titanic. One of the most famous earlier motion pictures was made in 1958. It was entitled A Night to Remember, based on a book by the same name. And then, of course, more recently, the 1997 film Titanic. There have been others. Those two are the most famous and the most recognizable. To be fair, my grandmother knew that that ship was going to sink. And she told people that. She told everyone who would listen that the ship was going to sink. In fact, she was still telling people when the ushers escorted her from the theater that night. However, this morning, I don't want to talk about the Titanic. But I do want to talk about a shipwreck. A shipwreck that's not as famous as the Titanic. A shipwreck that's not as well known as the Titanic. There have been no Hollywood versions of this shipwreck ever released, to my knowledge. And yet in this shipwreck, the entire ship was completely destroyed. And yet there was no loss of life. As our story begins, it's in the 27th chapter of the book of the Acts of the Apostles. There's a small merchant vessel anchored in the ancient port of Fair Havens. It's a port just off the coast of Crete in the Mediterranean Sea. And on the deck of that ship, there are four men who are engaged in a conference. There's a Roman officer named Julius, a courageous man, a gentleman. And Julius represents the military power of the Roman Empire. There is the owner of the vessel, who also owns the cargo as well. He represents capital, and his name is unknown to us. There's the captain of the ship, a man of the sea. And then the fourth man in this conference is a man by the name of Paul. And you might find Paul's presence to be a bit surprising. He doesn't belong to the army. He's not a man of wealth. He's not a man of the sea. He's actually a traveling preacher. He's a member of a despised sect, of a despised nation. And he's also a prisoner. And he's on his way to Rome to stand trial. And yet, strangely, we find Paul present at this conference. And the basis of the conference is this. They're trying to decide where to spend the winter. In the winter months, sea navigation on the Mediterranean Sea can become extremely treacherous. And so the question is, do they stay in the port of Fair Havens, or do they go 50 miles up to the coast, up the coast to the port of Phoenix? The harbor at Fair Havens is very small. And up the coast at Phoenix, there is a much larger harbor. Paul is in favor of remaining there at Fair Havens. Paul has a lot of experience with the sea. And Paul is convinced that to try and go up the coast is going to be a very dangerous proposition. But the captain of the ship, the man of the sea, the owner of the ship, the man that owns the ship and the cargo, they're of a different opinion. As they look out, it's a beautiful day. It's a lovely day in early autumn. Summer has seemed to come back for a return engagement. The skies are a beautiful shade of blue. The sea is calm, and there's a gentle south wind blowing, as soft as a baby's breath. Now, they're aware of the dangers of sea travel on the Mediterranean. They are aware it's the season of the year when sailing is dangerous, but the captain and the owner of the vessel, both are of the opinion they can reach that more desirable port of Phoenix without serious risk. And so the owner and the captain argue for the wisdom of setting sail at once from Fair Havens up the coast. But the final decision belongs to Captain Julius. You see, it's a merchant vessel. But though it's a merchant vessel, it is in government service, and therefore Captain Julius is the one to make the final decision. But Captain Julius is not a man of the sea. So he does the most natural and reasonable thing under the circumstances. He takes the opinion of the captain and the owner of the vessel, because they are, after all, experienced. They're the men to be most trusted in this situation. And so they weigh anchor and they set sail. But Mother Nature has other plans. They've barely gotten out of the harbor, and the skies become overcast. That gentle southerly breeze whips to the northeast, and that breeze rises quickly into the dimensions of a hurricane. And that once calm and placid sea begins to toss and turn with waves, and it begins to rage. And all four of the men in that conference realize something. They know they've made a mistake. But they also know they've reached a point of no return. It's too late to change their mind. It's too late to have a do-over. They've got to face the consequences of making a wrong choice. The ship is caught. The ship is unable to stay on course. The first day, they run under the shelter of an island. And there they're able to haul the lifeboat up on the deck. But then they have to begin to undergird the ship. Because with the tossing and churning and of the sea and the tossing of the waves, the ship is actually threatening to fall to pieces on them. It's a wooden ship, after all. This was 2,000 years ago. And the second day, the storm only has gotten worse. It is not abated, so they lighten the ship. They throw the cargo overboard. And the third day, with the storm still raging, they throw whatever furnishings of the ship could be spared overboard to further lighten the ship. They've done now everything. Everything they can possibly do, humanly possible, for their safety. There's nothing left for them to do except to sit in idleness and let this storm continue to rage. And then there followed a fifth day of the storm, and a sixth, and a seventh. It's impossible to prepare food. They didn't have any MREs. And there wasn't any eating going on, and most of the men on board the ship were too sick to eat. And others were too hopeless and fearful of the coming doom. This persistent fury of the hurricane is slowly but surely wearing away their morale. And then come other days. Other tempestuous days, dreary days, days with no sun, hideous nights with no stars in the sky. Almost 2 weeks have passed, and the storm is still blowing in all of its fury. The strain begins to take its toll. The strain is too great. The ordeal is too heavy for human nature to bear without a loss of courage. We read this in Acts 27. When neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. That's easy to believe, isn't it? 2 weeks on board this ship. 2 weeks on board this ship with nothing to eat. A continuous storm. No hope they had. All hope that we'd be saved was taken away. Now think about this. Who was on board this ship? Those sailors on board that ship, those were not men that were naturally cowards. Those were men who were men of the sea. The sailors on board that ship are men who've been hardened over time, over the years, by facing many dangers on the sea. More than once, those men had been in hand-to-hand combat with death on sailing vessels. They're brawny men, they're brave men, but after 2 weeks of a storm, that strain has become more than they can bear. Death, doom, gloom is creeping up on them hour by hour, and hope has given way to utter despair. Write this down. When men and women lose hope, it's always a dark hour. A hopeless man or a hopeless woman is of no value to themselves, and they're of no value to anyone else. And when we lose hope, we're likely to throw life away as being utterly paltry and absolutely worthless. But on board that ship, all hope that they have been would be saved has been taken away, and yet hope on board that ship is on its way to a resurrection. For that desperate crew on board that ship, hope is fixing to have a revival. And to be sure, they would never have believed it was even a possibility. They would have thought it was a dream entirely too good to come true. But it came true. And it came true in an amazing fashion. Can you see them? Can you see those men by an eye of faith? The crew huddled together on the deck, soaked by the waves, no dry thread of clothes anywhere, hungry, afraid, hopeless, filled with despair. Men on board that ship feeling like there is nothing left for them to do except just sit there and wait for a violent, tragic end to their lives. And yet, the expected disaster does not come true. In the place of the expected disaster comes hope. suddenly, the traveling preacher Paul stands in the middle of all of these men. This preacher, whose presence meant so little to them when the voyage started, this preacher now seems to count for something. Paul comes from a secret place of prayer. And coming from a secret place of prayer, with great difficulty, Paul steadies himself on the deck of the ship. The deck's slippery. The water splashes around him. The water splashing in the hull that's taken on water. The wind is shrieking overhead. Death is laughing at them as it blows among the torn rigging of the ship. And above that noise and above that din and above that storm, Paul lifts up his voice and he says, "Be of good cheer." What? How in the name of common sense can Paul dare, under those conditions, to speak those words? How can he say, "Be of good cheer"? Is he offering men who are facing death squarely in the face some kind of false hope? What does this man base his call to hope and courage on? It's not based on anything tangible. It's not based on anything visible. He doesn't say, "Men, calm yourselves, be of good cheer. We have a Roman officer on board this ship." It's a lot of comfort. It's not, he doesn't remind them of the seaworthiness of the vessel they're on. It's about to break into pieces. He doesn't say, "Be of good cheer, the storm is clearing and the skies are turning sunny again," because they can see for themselves that's not happening. So how does he say that? What does he base his concept on when he says, "Be of good cheer"? He bases it on his faith in God. He says, "Be of good cheer, for I believe God." He says, "Be of good cheer, for I believe God, whose I am and whom I serve." Paul was a man who dared to stand up in the presence of what seemed to be inevitable disaster and proclaim his faith in the God of heaven. He says, "Be of good cheer, gentlemen, for I believe God. I belong to God. God belongs to me. I've been in communion with God. God has been in communion with me. And I have asked God, not simply for my own life, I've asked Him for every one of you. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as He told me." Let me read it exactly from Acts chapter 27, verse 22. "And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this day, this night, the angel of God, whom I am and whom I serve, saying, 'Fear not, Paul. Thou must be brought before Caesar, and God has given thee all them that sail with thee.'" Now look at verse 25. "Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as He told me." What good did it do? What good did it do to have this mighty believer on board the ship? What did Paul's faith do for him? What did it do for the others? When Paul said, "I believe God," Paul didn't just sit down and leave things alone altogether. He did himself and insisted on his fellows doing all that was humanly possible. Real faith leads to action. To claim to believe and to do nothing is sheer presumption. Paul did something. He saw to it that he and the others should be as physically fit as possible for the ordeal they were facing. He urged upon those on board the ship the necessity of eating. He set the example. He took a bit of food and he gave food to the others. Standing among those hunger-weakened, fearful, weary soldiers and sailors, Paul asked a blessing. And then he began to eat. And as those on board the ship saw him eating, they had the courage to eat also. Paul held them together. Today, the last person to leave a foundering vessel is the captain and the crew. It was not necessarily so in that far-off day and time. In fact, the sailors were going to try to escape in the only lifeboat that they had. Paul was clear-eyed enough that he recognized this cowardly piece of trickery. You ought to read the story, the whole story in Acts 27. It's very interesting. And Paul told Captain Julius, he said, unless these sailors remain in the ship, we can't be saved. So they took their short swords, cut the ropes, and let the lifeboat just drift off into the sea. In that way, Paul held every one of them together. Faith is ever a uniting force. Did you hear that? Faith is ever a uniting force. Our world must be held together by faith in a common God, or it cannot be saved. Paul, that day, Paul brought courage and hope to men who were in utter despair. And my friends, that is a blessing. Cowardice is contagious. But thank God, so is courage. A man or woman in a panic can frighten a whole community. But when these men on board that vessel saw calmness, courage, and hopefulness in the eyes of Paul, they began to calm down, have hope, and become courageous also. Paul saved the situation. When the ship was wrecked, there was no panic. Every man on board the ship faced the ordeal with calmness and courage. Those who could swim jumped into the sea first. And they did that so they could be able to help others. And then followed after them those who could not swim. And not one of them was drowned. Some on boards, some on broken pieces of the ship. And it came to pass that all, Dr. Luke tells us, all escaped safe to land. And the man that held them all together, the man that brought about that great salvation, was Paul. A man of faith. A great believer. A man who had a faith strong enough to cause him to obey the Lord. A man who had made Jesus Christ the Lord and Master of his life. A man that would later come to the end of his journey on this earth and say, I'm now ready to be offered, the time of my departure is at hand. I've fought a good fight. I finished the course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness that the God, the righteous judge, shall give me in that day. And not me only, but all them that love his appearing. That's in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. Can that be said of us? Can it be said of me and you this morning that we are great believers? Is our faith strong enough to encourage and inspire others that we come in contact with to have a great faith? Is Jesus Christ the Lord and Master of my life to such an extent that if I came to the end of my journey today, I could say with Paul, I have fought a good fight, I've finished the course, I've kept the faith, there's a crown of righteousness laid up for me? Is our faith strong enough to live a life of obedience? Or do I need to make changes? Do we need to make changes? I don't know what's going on in your life. I don't know how deep your faith is, how strong your faith is, how obedient your faith is. But if you need to make changes for Jesus to be Lord and Master of your life, if we can help you make those changes. The song that we're going to sing has a beautiful title. Is thy heart right with God? Is it? Or do you need to make changes? It's your opportunity to make those changes as together we stand and while we sing.